Hello, and thanks for turning on The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly podcast. I'm Bruce Jacobs, a producer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week for a very presidential edition of our program. In this episode, former Czech president and world-renowned playwright Václav Havel talks to us about his directorial debut on the new movie based on his play called Leaving. Our Moscow bureau interviews former Soviet president Mikhail Gorbachev. The former Soviet president lashes out at Russia's current president and prime minister.
I am ashamed of them. They are acting arrogantly, as if we have no society, no constitution.
And the outgoing president of RFERL, Jeff Gedman, talks with me about social media and the internet battlefield.
This new information warfare is like traditional warfare, and we know what happens in traditional warfare. Every measure invites a countermeasure.
But we begin with our regular segment called Uncovered. This is where we discuss some of the best original reporting coming out of RFERL's 20 local bureaus, stories that are often underreported or uncovered by Western media. This week I'm talking with editor Pete Baumgartner in Prague. Now, Tunisia and Egypt have inspired anti-government uprisings in North Africa and the Middle East, and now there's been a warning that the revolutionary fever might reach all the way to Armenia. What's going on there, Pete?
Yeah, well, on Friday of last week, Levanter Petrosian, who's the most popular opposition leader in Armenia, he warned the government that unless they hold early elections, both presidential and parliamentary, that there could be Egypt-like repercussions for the government.
Well, how much influence or credibility does Ter Petrosian have when it comes to a statement like this?
Well, Petrosian is the former president, and he also is the leader of the largest opposition grouping in Armenia, and had about 10,000 people at his rally last week, which is the largest opposition rally since 2008, when there were mass demonstrations against the results of the presidential election.
Well, my next question would be, why does he want early elections? Why now? What will that accomplish?
The opposition believes that the 2008 elections were fraudulent, the presidential elections, and it's a question of legitimacy. They say this government, this president, and the parliament that supports him is illegitimate, and they've in fact refused to negotiate with the government until there are new elections.
Is that a legitimate claim that the elections were fraudulent?
The Western election monitoring organizations all said that there were irregularities and that the election did not meet international standards.
Well, let's turn to Iran now. There's word that the opposition leader, Mehdi Karoubi, is under house arrest, and he wants to directly confront government officials who say he should be charged with crimes against the state. What's going on there?
Yeah, both Mehdi Karoubi and Mir Hossein Mousavi, the other opposition leader, these two men are considered to be the leaders of the Green Movement in Iran. They both have been under house arrest since February 14. And several Iranian officials last week came out and said that they needed to be arrested and prosecuted. And Karoubi kind of took that and responded by saying, go ahead, let's have a trial. I'm ready to defend myself. I just asked that it be covered by the media and that it be public, that people be able to watch it.
There have also been arrests of family members as well. What happened there?
That's right. This week, both his son and his daughter-in-law, Karoubi's that is, were arrested. The daughter-in-law was later released, but the son is still being held. And his eldest son was they tried to arrest him, but he is apparently in hiding now.
Well, also in Iran, we had a story this week that an Iranian diplomat has resigned his post in an act of protest against the government. What are the details there?
Yes, on Sunday we had an interview with Ahmed Maleki, who is the head of Iran's consular office in Milan, Italy, and he was resigning his position, he told us, because of the barbaric actions by his government against the Iranian nation, was what he said. And he is now the fourth Iranian diplomat to break away from the government, to join the Green Movement in the past year. All of those four were serving in Europe.
Has there been any Iranian government reaction to his or the other resignations?
Usually the foreign ministry comes out. I haven't heard anything about this particular case, but in previous incidents they have come out and said that his term was ending basically and that it was just time for him to move on and that it wasn't really a resignation. It was more like his term was ending.
Okay. Well, Pete Baumgartner, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
говорить радіо.
Зараз радіо Сунда, контекст вершина
башня. Радіо Фердо, по шома хас.
Говорить радіо Свобода.
А за тицюн КТМ.
Former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev is leveling harsh criticism at Russia's current ruling duo, President Dmitry Medvedev and Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. In an exclusive interview with RFURL's Russian service correspondent Ludmila Telen, Gorbachev says he's ashamed of the way Russia is being governed.
What is your main complaint about the current Russian government?
It is too slow in resolving the problems of democracy.
Slow, that seems like a gentle way of putting it.
Well, something is being done. Although, yes, you're right, there is regression. You have to look at it in the context of what is happening around the world. By the end of the 20th century, authoritarian or dictatorial governments in more than 100 countries had exited the political stage. But now, just a few years later, authoritarian leaders are again beginning to win support among voters.
Do you have Russia in mind?
Yes. From the point of view of democracy, we have everything. We have a parliament, we have courts, we have a press, we have everything. But the results are vanishingly few.
Why is this? Why are the people in power so far away from the ideals of perestroika?
Because they weren't elected. Those were not elections. Since 1989 and 1990, when the former republics of the Soviet Union held their first democratic elections, we haven't had any genuinely free elections. Just look at how the present leadership is formed. They select their acquaintances, people with whom they studied, their former neighbors who they played soccer with, people they did business with and continue doing business with. That is the main thing. Personal loyalty, acquaintanceship, friendly relations. I reject this approach. Absolutely.
But friends won't betray you, while your inner circle betrayed you in August 1991.
And it doesn't matter that they betray the people instead, skimming off property and quietly sending money out of the country, instead of a war on corruption and imitation. And what is the result? The same pants, only with the zipper in the back, as the people say.
But Vladimir Putin won elections. Even if you concede that some vote padding was thrown in, there's no doubt that the majority voted for him in 2000 and in 2004.
Well, if all elections were genuinely free, then there would be significantly more representatives of the opposition among Putin's opponents. Elections would be genuinely competitive, and then it would have been a completely different story. Take a country with a developed democracy. They have three or four parties represented in parliament, and none of them have more than 40% of the seats. Those who have a plurality have to compromise with the opposition.
You've predicted that Vladimir Putin will again become president of Russia in 2018.
I never said that, by the way. What is worth talking about is how the leaders of the country discuss the presidential elections among themselves. By the initiative of one or the other, they will discuss their futures among themselves. This is shameful. I am ashamed of them. They are acting arrogantly, as if we have no society, no constitution, no system of elections, and so on. The two of them will decide. They do umvirate. And what about the 140 million of us out here? I have said many times, I don't like this. They already believe themselves to be the saviors of the country. But I think we are far from that.
Do you think an Egyptian scenario is possible in Russia?
Yes, if we waste time, if we don't resolutely defend our rights as citizens, and if we don't create an effective parliament that is capable of controlling the executive branch. You might ask, why don't they control it now? After all, they have all the necessary authority. That means that there are super mechanisms or sub mechanisms that are at work. If everything remains the way it is now, then I think the chances of an Egypt scenario will increase.
Don't you think that Khodorkovsky is in prison because Russia's leaders see him as a potential political leader and a possible political rival?
I don't think he is a leader. And if they are afraid of him, that is their affair.
Would you wish it for Russia that Putin becomes president again in 2018?
No, I think in general we should establish that no one may occupy that position for more than two terms.
Jeff Gedman has just ended a four-year tenure as the president of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. He's moving on to become the CEO of the Legatum Institute, a leading policy think tank in London. He joins me now in our Prague studio to talk about some of the challenges media organizations like RFERL face. I'll start with what you might call a hot trending topic. Now, rightly or wrongly, many people are saying that social media like Facebook and Twitter played a significant role in the revolution in Egypt. Now, there are those like scholar Evgeny Morozov who say that that's only because the Egyptian government didn't know how to play the game. Now, countries like Iran and China are much more adept at using the internet to go on both offense and defense. And since RFERL broadcasts to Iran, how do you see the role of social media there? And is there a danger that the internet might be a more powerful force for repression rather than freedom?
First of all, this new information warfare is like traditional warfare. And we know what happens in traditional warfare. Every measure invites a countermeasure. So when freedom-loving people realize that these new technologies help them connect, communicate, inspire each other, trade information, and mobilize, of course it's also true that repressive regimes think, as they've thought in the past, we can use these same technologies to divide people, to disinform people, to confuse people, and to break down their mobilization. That's the one point. The second point that I think is maybe more important and gets lost in the debate is while Twitter or Facebook or other social media can connect and mobilize people and bring them into the streets, and under certain circumstances it can support them in bringing down autocratic unjust governments, but what it doesn't do is tell those same people how to rule justly if they take over. It doesn't tell them how to build institutions. It doesn't tell them about the habits and values and behaviors that are needed in a liberal democracy. It tells more about how to connect, mobilize, and tear something down than actually build something up.
Do you see any of the social media currently having traction in Iran?
Well, some of it does. You know, we have a colleague here at RFERL named Golnaz Esfandiari who has written very thoughtfully about this subject. And Golnaz, I think, does a very good job of avoiding the polar extremes in the debate. It does nothing. It does everything. It's a panacea. But by all accounts, Iran's youthful population, I think 60-70% is under the age of 30, likes being online when they can be, likes blogging and likes social media. But as you pointed out in the top of this discussion, the Iranian regime likes social media too. And they jam and they block and they bring systems down and they infiltrate.
Let's turn now to Russia. The Russian media is widely seen as falling under the ever tighter control of the Kremlin. But the BBC recently announced it would end its Russian language radio broadcasts. Now, RFERL broadcasts there. Is there a future for international broadcasters like RFERL in places like Russia?
Well, I think there is. I regret the BBC decision. I know our own predicament and dilemma. It's not unlike BBC and others. The predicament is this, Bruce. For 10 years now, during the rule, so to speak, of Vladimir Putin, Putinism, the Russian government has been slowly constricting and closing space for free and independent media. They do it through a variety of methods, and it's often the same way that they deal with NGOs. Sometimes it's harder tactics, and sometimes it's the health inspector and the tax collector and the anti-corruption police. But the intent is the same. It's to close space for free and independent media. If you define the future as being governed by numbers, it's bleak. And I don't think any media company from the West with real values and real teeth to its journalism is going to get numbers anytime soon in this Russia. But You know, I really think this is the moment when the Russians need accurate, reliable, fair-minded, honest, hard-hitting journalism. The numbers are going to be smaller. The regulatory system is going to be repressive. The political situation is going to be really tough and prickly. It's difficult for numbers, but maybe not difficult for influence.
It's been said that RFERL is in the business of trying to go out of business. That is, the more freedom and democracy there is in countries that RFERL broadcasts to, the less there is a need for those broadcasts. Is there any country or countries where you feel there's been good progress towards that goal?
If you look at our countries, sadly, you've had more backsliding than progress. I mean, you know, during my tenure, Bruce, 4 years of president of RFERL coincided with the leadership of Mr. Ahmadinejad in Iran. It's not been a healthy, positive time for free and independent media. For Russia and its so-called near abroad, and that means Belarus and Ukraine, Caucasus and Central Asia, if you look at groups like Freedom House, the last 10 years have been very difficult years for political liberties, political rights, civil liberties, and free media. There are other parts of the world where the record is rather mixed, but sadly for our broadcast region, it is more backslide than progress.
Jeff Gedman, thanks for joining us.
Bruce, thanks.
You're listening to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's new weekly podcast. Former Czech president Václav Havel is set to release his first feature film. It's the latest career twist for the absurdist playwright and former anti-communist dissident who led 1989's Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia. The film Leaving, or Odcházení, is based on Havel's first play in 20 years, which premiered in 2008. It's about the former chancellor of an unnamed country dealing with the loss of power after stepping down. RFERL's Gregory Pfeiffer spoke with Havel at his office in Prague.
You've said that Leaving is about the meaning of power in a politician's life, one of the themes. Can you briefly explain the central character's dilemma?
I wanted a general question, the problem of change and leaving, to be felt in the subtext of the play and the film. Change is continual. People are always leaving. Settings change, as do ways of life. That's what the play is about. The protagonist can't handle change well. He stops functioning. His whole world collapses around him. He responds in the worst way possible, adapting to a subordinate position that serves the new state of affairs. In a general theme, that doesn't document any particular person or specific act of leaving.
Speaking of change, you began writing the play in 1989. How differently would it have turned out, do you think, had you finished it then?
It hasn't changed a great deal from the original idea, which came to me 22 years ago. I enriched it only with some details from my later experience. For example, the issue of dividing possessions into government-issued and personal. That's a somewhat obscure procedure I went through at the Prague Castle when I was stepping down as president. I've used those kinds of minor experiences, although the main theme is from an earlier date.
The theater of the absurd seemed very well suited to describing the social ills under communism in Czechoslovakia. Do you think the theater of the absurd is as relevant today as it was back then?
Speaking about myself, I've been pleasantly surprised that my older plays are still being performed. Most important is that they still have something to say to today's audience, in particular the young people who enjoy my plays. That's the best I could hope for, that these plays aren't single-use products of one era.
May I ask you your next project?
I'd like to write one more play that's taking shape in my head right now. Then, if possible, I'd like to move into some kind of retirement. There are some things I've started that I'll have to continue to the end of my life. But I'm not planning any projects besides finishing my film and writing one more play. Although sometimes things just surface.
That was Gregory Pfeiffer's interview with Václav Havel. Videos of the Havel and Gorbachev interviews are available on our website, rfrl.org. And that's all we have for this week. I'm Bruce Jacobs. Thanks for turning on the blender from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
Rather